Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, October 15th. We begin with some of the news out of the Decatur Herald and Review, beginning with Huey Freeman's article, Man Charged with Attack on Fellow Jail Inmate. Brett A. Ballard, an 18-year-old Decatur man awaiting trial for allegedly shooting a man with a shotgun in August, was back in court Tuesday on new charges after he allegedly battered a fellow jail inmate. About 9:30 p.m. Saturday, corrections officers at the Macon County Jail were sent to a jail section in response to a fight between inmates. A 23-year-old inmate who had, quote, numerous red marks on his face, end quote, reported that Ballard entered his cell and tried to push him out of it. When his attempt failed, he closed the door and began to repeatedly strike the other inmate in the face with closed fists, the inmate reported, according to a probable cause affidavit by Sergeant Ronald Atkins. When officers questioned Ballard, he admitted that he entered the inmate's cell, closed the door, and began fighting. Surveillance video shows Ballard entering his cell behind the other inmate. He is then pushed backwards, re-enters the cell, and closes the door, the affidavit said. Ballard, who is being held without bond, has been incarcerated since August 6 in connection with an incident in which a 29-year-old man was shot and wounded in his left arm and hand. The victim told police he was driving away from a residence in the 3200 block of East Garfield Avenue the night of July 31st when Ballard fired at him with a shotgun four or five times as Ballard sat in the front passenger seat of a vehicle parked in the driveway of that residence. The victim was interviewed by police at Decatur Memorial Hospital where he was treated for his wounds. A witness who was on the scene on Garfield Avenue also identified Ballard as the shooter. Police found four spent 16-gauge shotgun shells in the driveway of the residence where the shooting occurred. Ballard was arraigned August 7th on one Class X count of aggravated battery with a firearm, in addition to two Class 1 felony counts of aggravated discharge of a firearm. After entering a plea of not guilty, he is due in court for a pretrial hearing in that case October 22nd. He is on probation for 24 months after a juvenile adjudication in February for aggravated unlawful use of a weapon or vehicle. Ballard is due in court for his arraignment in his most recent case by Tuesday. Our next article, also by Huey Freeman, man accused of chasing, battering student at middle school. A 21-year-old Decatur man entered a plea of not guilty to a felony charge of aggravated battery after he was arrested for allegedly chasing a student into Thomas Jefferson Middle School and slamming him up against a wall. At a preliminary hearing Wednesday, Decatur Patrol Officer Scott Marquis testified that the student suffered an abrasion to his elbow area when Bradley Dassenbrock shoved him into the school wall in an incident that occurred September 24th. Many witnesses saw Dassenbrock coming out of the school, said Marquis, under cross-examination from a Macon County Public Defender Rodney Forbes. One witness saw Mr. Dassenbrock holding the victim against the wall, Marquis said. Shortly after the incident, the 14-year-old male student told police that shortly after school was dismissed for the day, he was chased back into the school entryway by Dassenbrock, said a probable cause affidavit by Marquis, written shortly after the arrest. Officers spoke with multiple witnesses who advised they were alarmed and disturbed by Bradley Dassenbrock's actions, Marquis wrote in his statement. Dassenbrock was arrested that day and booked into the Macon County Jail. He was released October 7th after posting $750 cash bail. Conditions of his bond prohibit contact with the victim and traveling to the middle school located at 4735 East Cantrell Street. At the time of his arrest, Assenbrock was serving a 24-month probation term for a conviction of aggravated battery against a 14-year-old girl. He pleaded guilty to one felony count in that case after he was originally charged with four counts of aggravated battery and two misdemeanor counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. Assenbrock was charged with repeatedly grabbing and fondling the buttocks and crotch of the victim. He was originally sentenced to the probation term in that case on October 11, 2013. Assenbrock was subsequently sentenced to 120 days in jail on July 7, 2015, for two probation violations. As part of his original sentence, he was ordered to take part in sex offender treatment. Assenbrock is due in court for a pretrial hearing in his most recent case, November 17th. Our next story is a sad one about Hastert, and it's an AP Wire story. Hastert attorney says former speaker intends to plead guilty. It's an AP Wire story, maybe. I said that out of Chicago. An attorney for Dennis Hastert has told a federal judge that the former House Speaker intends to plead guilty in a federal hush money case. John Gallo said during a brief hearing Thursday that he expects to have a written plea agreement by Monday, and he asked the judge to set a date for a change of plea. The judge scheduled an October 28th hearing. Gallo did not mention any of the terms, including what counts Hastert would plead guilty to. A plea deal would avert a trial and help keep any potentially embarrassing secrets quiet. The 73-year-old Illinois Republican is charged with breaking banking laws and lying to the FBI in efforts to pay someone $3.5 million to hide claims of past misconduct. The Associated Press and other media, citing anonymous sources, have reported that the payments were meant to conceal claims of sexual misconduct decades ago. Our next article comes out of Springfield, written by Kurt Erickson, who is the H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. Disabled lose state allowance increase. A decision by Governor Bruce Rauner's administration to reduce monthly allowances for developmentally disabled residents will be under a microscope next week during a special hearing in the capital city. On Tuesday, advocates will argue against the reduction, which will save a total of $3 million, but will leave an estimated 16,000 disabled people with less spending money. At issue is an allowance that is given to residents in larger intermediate care facilities and group homes. Under former Governor Pat Quinn, a Democrat, the amount had been increased for the first time in two decades to $60 per month. The Rauner administration, however, says the increase wasn't specifically renewed, meaning the allowance returned to its previous level of $30 for individuals living in care facilities and $50 for those in group homes when the budget year ended June 30th. Last year, the personal needs allowance was increased by the General Assembly for only the upcoming fiscal year, and this increase already expired on June 30th this year. The hearing is related to implementing formal rules to reflect this, said John Hoffman, spokesman for the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services. Supporters of the increase say the Rauner administration's interpretation of the rule is incorrect. A rule put in place in March established the dollar amount at the higher level and did not include an expiration date. Efforts to convince state officials to reverse the decision haven't been successful, leaving the disabled with less money to spend on snacks, toiletries, and entertainment. I don't think there's been any movement, said Ed McManus, a Chicago-area disability consultant. Josh Evans of the Illinois Association of Rehabilitation Facilities agreed. I see no evidence that the administration is going to take a different approach on this, Evans said. We think they are operating in violation of current rules. Evans said the June 30th reduction came as a surprise after the administration agreed to the new rule in March. We were mortified, he said. They've done an about-face on us. The hearing is set for 1 p.m. Tuesday in the Prescott E. Bloom Building in Springfield. Our next article is written by Sharon Barricklow for the Herald and Review. This is from Shelbyville, Shelby County, to join Christian County 911. Emergency callers in Shelby County will receive their 911 service from Christian County beginning in 2017 under an agreement approved Wednesday by the Shelby County Board. The Board approved a resolution authorizing Chairman David Cruett to finalize plans with Christian County for enhanced 911 service. Shelby County currently receives their 911 service from Coles County in a process the federal government will not approve after 2017. Shelby County Emergency Management Director Jared Rowcliffe said Christian County could offer Shelby County more than the Coles County arrangement. We want some representation on the 911 board, he said. Christian County is offering a true merger. With Coles, we would consolidate with them, but they would be the lead agency. In Christian County, if there are 11 seats on a new board, we would have 5. They would have 6 because their county population is larger than ours. Rowcliffe said 911 calls would be routed to Taylorville's Christian County Sheriff's Office and dispatched directly to Shelby County Emergency Services. Currently, calls are sent to Coles County, which then notifies Shelby County Dispatching of the need for services. Once everything is done, a caller will dial 911 and it goes to Taylorville with a rollover to Pena Police Department, and they will page out the appropriate agency. With new fiber wiring, we will have a direct connection with them. That's something Shelby County Sheriff Don Kuntz said would help emergency services. Our dispatchers will have the exact same call on their screens, he said. They can add information as needed. The mapping system we have now makes it clear where the call is coming from, how to find the emergency, and who are the appropriate responders. Rowcliffe said Shelby County currently receives about $110,000 annually in telephone taxes for 911 service, money that is currently paid to Coles County. He said any additional costs in adding enhanced 911 service would be paid through federal grants. Because we don't have enhanced 911, there are grants available that will help offset the cost, he said. We hope this won't add any additional cost to the county, but will increase county service. Our next article was written by Allison Petty, who's a staff writer for the Decatur Herald and Review. Second phase of stormwater fee starts next month. The second phase of a stormwater utility fee will begin appearing on Decatur property owners' water bills next month. For most residents, the change will only amount to an additional 67 cents per month. Businesses could face higher numbers depending on the size of the property and the amount of hard surface it contains. That comes on top of a $3 per parcel monthly base fee that the city began charging all property owners last fall. The revenue stream, approved by the Decatur City Council in April 2014, is intended to pay for long-needed fixes to the stormwater system. Heavy rains can cause dozens of homeowners to find themselves with flooded basements, Public Works Director Rick Marley said. City consultants who evaluated the stormwater infrastructure in 2009 estimated $60 million worth of improvements were needed. For years, people have asked the city to try to do something. You've got to stop this flooding, Marley said. We had absolutely no funding to make it happen. The fee is designed so that property owners will pay according to how much stormwater flows off of their property and into the city's pipes, gutters, streets, and drainage ditches. Non-residential property owners will likely pay more, with city engineers using aerial mapping technology to calculate the amount of hard surface on their property and charge the fee accordingly. Every 4,500 square feet of impervious surface is considered an equivalent residential unit, or ERU, that will cost 67 cents. For instance, the owner of a parcel with 45,000 square feet of impervious surface would pay a total of $9.70 per month. The city recently unveiled a credit manual that details ways to obtain a discount. Property owners must show that they have decreased the burden their property creates on the city's stormwater infrastructure. This could be done in a variety of ways, from rain barrels and rain gardens to detention ponds and permeable pavement. Entities with a large amount of hard surface, such as Archer Daniels Midland Company and the Decatur Park District, were invited to participate in creating the credit manual, said Troy Hall, a civil engineer for the city. For those and other businesses, there could be financial incentives to make improvements to their properties. It's another story for most homeowners who would pay more to apply for the credits than they could save. Credits do not apply to the $3 base fee, so average homeowners could save 10 to 20% of 67 cents per month. To apply for the residential credit, they must pay a $25 fee meant to offset the cost of the city processing the application. Marley acknowledged that it wouldn't make financial sense for residents to seek the credit, but said they might do so for other reasons. There are people out there right now who are environmentally conscious, and they already have rain barrels in place. Some people want to have rain gardens in place, he said. Not everything is done because of money. Of course, for properties with a lot of hard surface, the credits could have a bigger effect. Schools will even be eligible for an education credit. Hall said he has gotten several calls from residents who are concerned about the fee. Many people didn't realize how much stormwater infrastructure the city must maintain, he said. Even if you don't have storm sewers, it's likely you have ditches, and those ditches also have to be maintained, he said. Basically, when it rains, it's going to rain on every parcel in the city. Water, for the most part, is going to run off each of those parcels, and the city has to manage the water that runs off of those parcels. A credit manual, including a detailed description of how to design a rain garden, is available at the city's website, decaturil.gov. Applications for the various credits can also be downloaded there. Anyone with further questions can contact Hall at area code 217-424-2747. We're heading on over to the Decatur Tribune to pick up Paul Osborne's City Beat column. And it seems that it's some of it, maybe a good part of it, appears to be about the never-ending story on the proposed new Aldi store. And it's a little like Hillary Clinton's emails. Okay, here we go. Paul Osborne's column. Vote on rezoning for new Aldi's store coming up for City Council. Hopefully, when the City Council meets in the Decatur Civic Center Theater Monday night, there will be a decision made regarding proposed rezoning to allow a new Aldi's store to be built at Route 51 and Ash Avenue. Residents of the neighborhood most affected by the rezoning decision, along with other citizens who do not live in the area, have been putting up a strong battle to convince the council not to approve the rezoning and open the door for Aldi's. Opponents have spoken out at council meetings through letters to the editor and other methods to express their feelings about the harm that would be caused to the neighborhood by adding more traffic to an already high traffic area and busy intersection. It's not often that a regular city council meeting needs more room to accommodate everyone who wants to attend, as will be the case for Monday night's meeting. I don't recall that, during the years I chaired the regular council meetings, that we ever used the theater to conduct a meeting. I remember a few times when the council chamber was packed and there wasn't even standing room available. I think there's also been once or twice during the year since I left office the theater has been used for a council meeting because of a controversial vote facing the city council. Actually, having so many people pack the council chambers to let their opposition feelings be known is probably more effective for the opponents than having the same number of opponents show up in the huge theater. Good point. Councilman Pat McDaniel released a statement last week indicating that he has already made his decision on how he will vote. It will be against rezoning the site. McDaniel's complete statement is located elsewhere in the Tribune. As I am writing this week's column, McDaniel is the only councilman to announce his decision on the vote. If the vote was taken today, I think rezoning would be rejected by a 4-3 vote of the council, but that's today. Predicting how any city council is going to vote on a controversial issue like rezoning is not a fine science. I can remember a few times when I was mayor that I was assured of how council members were going to vote on an agenda item, and 24 hours later, when the actual vote was taken, a few council members voted the other way. I think that's when I started getting gray hair. Anything can happen between now and Monday night when the council is expected to vote on rezoning the Route 51 and Ash Avenue area. Kind of a subnote, Dr. Ray's vote. Councilwoman Dana Ray's vote will be especially interesting to watch. Ray endorsed Bishop G.E. Livingston for mayor earlier this year and publicly stood her ground for Livingston when he was one of four finalists for the council seat left vacant when Julie Moore Wolf was appointed mayor. Livingston is chair of the Decatur Plan Commission and voted in favor of rezoning the area so Aldi can be built. However, Ray has been a very strong supporter of neighborhoods during her time on the council, which may cause her to vote against rezoning. The votes of all seven members, including the mayor, are important, but Ray's vote will be especially important. Every council meeting has a different order of when each member votes. The mayor always votes last and is the tiebreaker, which also puts more pressure on the mayor if the vote is 3-3 when he or she casts the deciding vote. This council vote on rezoning will be the most anticipated in a long time, and the stress level will be somewhat high, both in the audience and on the council. Although there will be a lot of attention on the first council member to vote, there will be plenty left over for the rest of the members as each one votes. Thanks to Nathan Pierce, Executive Director of the Macon County History Museum. Oops, another little side note. Thanks to Nathan Pierce, Executive Director of the Macon County History Museum, for getting the new Looking for Lincoln sign in place at the James Milliken Homestead. Last week in this column, I mentioned all of the work on the storyboards had been completed except one. at the Milliken Homestead. Now all are in place and looking great. I return now to the Decatur Herald in Review, who's got a cute little survey that said Decatur's favorite things to do and stop by a train, and that's what they asked some of the Tribune readers. And here are their responses. Look at Facebook, meditate, and saying that meditation is a way to ease your mind in what may otherwise be a stressful situation. Listen to music. I'm going through. Count the cars. That's what I do. Counting the boxcars or adding the boxcar numbers can keep your mind busy until the train passes. Play a phone game. Pray. Some take this time to pray. Read. Many residents keep a Kindle with them or a book in the car just for the occasion, which I understand happens with some frequency indicator. Clean the car. Being stopped by a train also seems to be the perfect opportunity to take some time and clean your car up a bit, if possible. Think. Clearing your mind, relaxing, and simply thinking is something you may not often have time to do, but it's a good way to pass time when stopped by a train. I like this one. Curse. Some residents may take the time to practice some curse words when stopped by a train. Clip or file your nails. Some people even clip or file their nails while waiting for a train to pass. Dare say some even paint their nails during that occasion. This one's a little unusual. Make use of a bubble wrap steering wheel cover. Some may even take the time to make a bubble wrap steering wheel cover just for such an occasion so you can pop those crazy things. Look for an alternative route. That's way too practical. Above all else, residents try to find alternate routes around the train instead of staying stuck. Well, you might have had other answers you would have sent in to the Decatur Herald in Review on things to do while waiting for the train to pass. I'm not sure what their next question will be, but that was it, I guess, earlier today or maybe yesterday. Decatur's favorite things to do when stopped by a train. Okay, it's Ruth McCauley. We need to take a bit of a break here, but we're going to be right back with the second half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, October 15th. I hope you'll hang on. For those of you got to leave, have a great day. Hope to read with you again real soon, but the rest of you, hang tight. We'll be right back.